introduce Emma Mason, who is going to be giving the next set of lectures and inspiring you all. And if you listen carefully, she will help you to do your second formative essay. I'm sure all of you know this, but the formative essay, the second formative assignment is up on the website for you to download. Again, this is this is a formative essay, so it doesn't contribute to your final assessment, but everybody has to do it except for visiting students. You can't pass the course unless you do these essays. And what you'll see is the first essay asked you to, first assignment asked you to do some close reading. This one takes you a stage on from that. So now you're being asked to present, to formulate and develop a persuasive and coherent argument, but also to support that argument through close reading. And this is sort of the next step on towards the kind of work that you'll need to do for your assessed essays. Okay, thanks.
I have a message for Joe Morrissey's seminar group. Joe's not in today, so his office hour and his seminar are cancelled, and just wait to hear from him. And if there's somebody from his seminar that isn't here and you know of them, please text them and let them know. Thanks.
Hi, can you hear me okay? Yes?
Good.
Get this on properly. You can't really see that, can you? There we go, let's go to... There we are. The overview of my lecture is down the side there. I haven't got a handout this week. Sometimes I do. You don't need to write anything down this week, just listen. Two things to start with. First of all, I have a problem with these lectures because, and I think it's a problem for you too, because basically you've just had lectures by Katia Genonati, who's probably the best lecturer in the department. So you're now your degree is just going to go downhill for the rest of the 3 years. So I can't possibly do any better. Also, 10 o'clock in the morning is practically like 5 o'clock in the morning to me. It's so difficult for me to get up this early and do a lecture. I'm sure it's difficult for some of you to be here and listen. So we're all in the same boat. But anyway, so as you know, this is the start of the lecture now. Here we are, number one, reading. This is a course about modes of reading, and Dr. Genonati gave you a series of ideas about how sexuality and gender help us to read Carter. But one of the things that Katia was talking about is not just that these kind of ideas about sexuality and gender help us to read a certain subject, but it's the way in which Carter writes about it that's important. She chooses the novel. Well, these lectures are about poetry because Hal is a poem, and we want to really think about why has Ginsberg chosen a poem to talk about the themes he's interested in, which are, I think, religion, politics, authorship, identity. And those are the things that we're going to be talking about for the next four, well, I'm going to be talking about for the next 4 weeks, and you can talk about whatever you like in your seminars. So I'll be talking about next week and the following weeks, Marx, Karl Marx, another theorist called Viktor Shklovsky. It's one of those words that you have to learn to know how to say. Michel Foucault, he's another person who no one knows how to pronounce his name. Roland Barthes. All of these figures are interested in the process of the experience of reading. And that's what I'm interested in. I don't really mind what you say about a text. I'm not really that concerned to know whether you get your reading right or wrong. What I think is important is to reflect on how you got to that answer. What is your experience of reading? And in a way, that's what I think Ginsberg is trying to ask us too. He wants us to think about how we read. And for Ginsberg, reading is a political act. He envisions it as a political act because he says reading Hal will hopefully shift the way in which you think about society, how you feel and you think about the society you live in. So for Ginsberg and for the other writers that I'm going to be talking about, they want us to think that reading causes us to kind of have an epiphany or an awakening. about our world, which then enables us to kind of challenge the problems that are inherent to the world, because the world is a very problematic place, says Ginsberg. It is, for him, in 1950s America. I'll talk about that later. But it is in general. It's a very unfair world. We all know that. It's unfair in little ways, and it's unfair in big ways. Now, some critics of Ginsberg, and critics, say sort of anti-Marxists, for example, would argue that, you know, why are you doing an English degree if you want to think about politics? Isn't the book just a shock absorber? You go off into your room, you read the poem, and you're not out on the street doing political action. Well, I think what's important about these figures we're looking at is, first of all, they don't recognize a break between the real world and literature. The whole world is a text, and if you don't know how to read it, you're not going to be very aware within it. And anyway, it's a stupid kind of binary to say, you know, if you're doing literature, you're not out on the street, because we've had millions of years of people doing political protests, and everything's the same. So we need a different way to think about how to challenge the fact that everything is the same. And that's what Ginsberg is asking us to do. So let's start by thinking about poetry and why poetry is so key for Ginsberg, and why he chooses it as a sort of a genre to reflect on these problems, these political problems in the world, but also as a genre that most engages your mind. I only work on poetry, and I don't say that in a kind of, I only read poems, kind of, you know, those people that are sort of trying to say, oh, you know, I only read Ovid in my spare time. No, I think poems are easier to read. They're short. Some of them are long, but it doesn't matter if they're long, because you can read them in little short bits, and you still feel okay if you've read three lines of a big epic. Whereas if you read three lines of, you know, Jane Eyre, you just feel like an idiot. I think that poems also allow you to kind of do what you want with them a bit more. There's a physical space around the poem which allows you to fill in the blank in the blanks, that space that is around the page, the spaces that are at the end of lines. Why don't they carry on? Why don't they go into the page? Well, that's so that we can think about what we think about those lines. No one has a set idea about what Howl is about. No critic really agrees what Howl is about. What does it mean? We don't know. Really, have you read it? What does it mean? There's bits of it that just don't make any sense. But we do expect to know what novels mean a lot of the time. We want them to have a narrative. We have a shared understanding, I think, of what Jane Austen's novels are about. We know roughly that they're all about poor, but usually beautiful, sisters that find happiness and redemption from true love and marriage. Or we know what Virginia Woolf's books are about. They're about rich but ugly sisters who are too miserable and too avant-garde and dreamy to find happiness. There's my summaries of those two authors. Obviously, lots of people will disagree with me, and that's, again, this course is modes of reading. Lots of people in the department would disagree with me, but you have to have your own perspective, and I'm telling you what mine is so that you know what I think about what Ginsberg is doing, because you can only have your own perspective on the way into these poems. You have to think about what your perspective is. And even if you can't find it in criticism, or even if you can find it in criticism, you know, you have to just think about, why have you got to the reading you've got to? Why do you think what you think? Again, I want you to think about your experience of reading. So I'm suggesting that poetry refuses straightforward, descriptive, narrative, linear ways of reading because of the way in which it sounds, and because it forces us to think about sounds orally with an O, how we speak about them, how we sound those words, and also hourly, how do we listen to the sounds on the page. Now, here on the website is a little, I'm going to come to this picture in a minute. Here it says, download the prosody guide. Doesn't that sound, you know, they have that thing on Radio 1 where everyone's like, download the podcast, you know, over, and it's like that. Download the prosody guide. Doesn't sound as fun as something on Radio 1. Actually, probably is more fun than anything on Radio 1. Prosody is a word that means the study of meter and rhythm in poetry. The study of meter and rhythm. And it's a language that helps you to describe your experience of sound. And it includes all of those words like iambs and trochees and amphibrax and amphimesis and all of those different kinds of words. Now, I used to lecture on those, and you wouldn't believe how boring it is to listen to someone describe what an iamb is in a lecture. So I've given you a handout on it so that you can think about it yourself. I would say, if you find those words helpful in your reading of poetry, there are lots of books that you can go off and read about prosody, and you can email me and I can recommend some to you. I would start with maybe Rhian Williams' book, Rhian Williams, The Poetry Toolkit, which is a great book on prosody. If you read those words and you feel alienated and uncomfortable by them, I would throw the prosody guide away and think about a different way for you to read poetry. Poetry is not supposed to be something that dictates to you how it should be read. It's something that is just words, and we have to think about sound, and we have to think about the way in which the sounds work. But the reason that things like iambs are so difficult is because, you know, some poems are written in dialect, so stresses are on different, you know, syllables anyway. And then you might read it, you've all got different accents. How are you sounding a word that's been written in dialect when, you know, somebody's got a Scottish accent, someone's got a, you know, a Birmingham accent? It doesn't really work in a universal way. It only works in a personalised way, which is why I think it's easier, I think, for you to go off and study prosody on your own, or maybe talk about it with your tutors and what it means to kind of read prosodically. What I think I will talk about is how I think it's important to think about poetry, as I said before, as a kind of an easy form. It still demands that you scan it, by which it means that you measure it and you think about the way in which you would stress certain words. How would I stress that line in Howl, holy, 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 holy? Where are the stresses in that line? I think that's an interesting exercise to think about. But there isn't a right answer, and you're not going to get it wrong, because it's a poem. Now, when I keep saying that I think poetry is easy, I mean that I think it is a genre that you need to approach in a kind of position of ease, if you like, of ease. Now, the reason I think that's important is because I think literary studies, and I think partly the British Western society is invested in thinking about poetry as difficult. There are lots of courses, especially in rich graduate schools in America, that have courses that are called things like poetry and difficulty and poetry and obscurity and, you know, poetry and something that's difficult that shows that we're very clever to be able to understand it. Even the new government, I'm going to put government in quotation marks there because they don't really know what they're doing in any way, but they've asked us to read more great poetry. They've told teachers to put more great poems on A-level. Difficult poems. What does that mean? What government minister can decide what a great poem is and a non-great poem? It's a ridiculous thing to say. But what we can decide is what sorts of poems we like. That doesn't mean it's great or not great. It means that there's a sort of aesthetic pleasure that we're getting for a particular reason. I find Howl aesthetically pleasurable to read. That's partly because of the rhythms, but it's partly because of the subject matter too, and the way in which Ginsberg deals with questions of religion and sexuality and politics in a quite funny way at times. Funny. So, poems, I'm suggesting, poems in a universal way create ease, by which I mean you need to approach them in an open and relaxed way. They create ease through their balance and harmony and rhythm, or through their subversion of balance and harmony and rhythm. There's a lot of poems that are arrhythmic or don't have rhythms at all. But even then, that kind of teaches us that these poems are about a different kind of feeling. Maybe they're about kind of being frightened, for example, if they're not rhythmic. Well, if we tense up to read a poem that's about fear, we're just going to feel frightened ourselves. We're not going to enter into the space of the poem itself. So I'm suggesting that any poem really needs to be approached in a kind of relaxed way. And one of the images that I find helpful in kind of thinking about how to read poem is this image here of Guan Yin. Here she is. That's how you should sit when you read poems. No, not really. But do sit with a straight back. It's very important to get your posture correct. This is Guan Yin, who is the Buddhist goddess of compassion and healing. I think Guan Yin is an amazingly interesting figure through which to think about reading poetry. The words Guan Yin, which are up there, roughly translate from Chinese into English as observing sounds of the world. Observing sounds. Not listening to sounds, observing sounds. You could also translate it as the one who sees and hears the cries of the world. Observing the sounds of the world, listening and hearing the cries of the world. In Buddhist tradition, Guan Yin is particularly good at hearing and seeing because she's enlightened. She's a goddess. Enlightened is a word that Buddhists use to refer to a state of mind that means being at ease. In the Buddhist tradition, enlightenment simply means someone that doesn't feel suffering anymore, feels no suffering, has managed to transcend suffering. But they're still living, they're still in a world that is suffering. Now, I'm not going to go on about Buddhism, because we're talking about poetry, but I think what's important about Guan Yin is the way in which she does stay on the earth. She kind of reaches the state of enlightenment. And in Buddhist tradition, if you get enlightened, you can either kind of, you enter into the state of nirvana and then you float off. It's a terrible description of what Buddhism's about, but, you know, let's just move on. Or you can stay on the stay in the world, stay in the real world as a lived material person like this here. This is a statue of a real Guan Yin. And you can stay and sort of observe the world and perhaps teach us how we can observe the world too. She is sitting there on a ledge, overlooking the world, just watching and hearing all of the cries. I think she's a bit like, have you seen, Superman Returns, the new Superman? Wasn't that great? I love Superman. You know when like Lois has written that article about how they don't need Superman anymore, and so Superman flies her out into the cosmos and sort of points her down. He says, you know, you wrote that the world doesn't need a savior, but every day I hear people crying for one, because really, Superman is Jesus. We all know that. And all the directors of Superman Returns know that. That's why they have him in all these crucifix poses all the time. So Guan Yin is a bit like Superman, because she has super hearing. She can hear and see everything. But she's not like Superman, because she doesn't try and fix it all. She doesn't have like superpowers and try and fly around the world really quickly. She just sits there in this particular posture that she has here. The Buddhists call this particular kind of posture, where she's sitting in this very relaxed way, the pose of ease, the pose of ease. That's what they call it. And I think that's the way in which we should psychologically, if not physically, be when we approach poems. We need to kind of think about how we can observe sounds, because that's what we're doing. When you read a poem in silence in your student room, you might read it out. I think you should read it out. Good. But I mean, if you're doing like these big long poems on Epic, you're not going to read. God, good for you if you do. I mean, but I couldn't read that out loud to myself in my room. You know, you'd get the student services coming round to see if you're all right. So you've got to think of a way of how you listen to different units of the poem. How do you observe sound? So I've already suggested that there's no particular way to observe sound, but that you need to be aware of what your way is. So you need to think about writing about how you read the poem. I'll just say that I also think ease is a generally good way of thinking about your studies and about the way in which you approach critical texts as well as poetry. because I think it kind of introduces a lot of positive connotations. It's sort of, I mean, ease means, if you look it up in the dictionary, ease literally means a sort of freedom from pain, worry, trouble. Reading isn't supposed to be an anxious experience where you sit there and you look at it for a very long time and then at some point you get the answer. That is a, I think, a sort of a difficult and wrong way of reading. It's also, I don't think, a good way of reading to sort of up in an uptight way try and just get to the end of the text and read it in this kind of straightforward linear way so that you can read it as quickly as possible and then have sort of authority over it. There's a critic that does that called Harold Bloom. Has anyone read Harold Bloom before? He's very famous. He's also looks very miserable and unhealthy to me. He's very conservative in his views on literature, but he became very famous in the 1960s and 70s. He used to write these essays on how many pages he'd read. He was that guy in your seminar who's like, I've read it all. Yeah, I read it all. I only read it twice, but, you know. And you're talking about, like, Paradise Lost or something like that. And he writes literally real essays where he talks about how fast he can read, how many pages he can get through in a minute. There's a great essay by a feminist critic called Elaine Showalter where she talks about why Harold Bloom might feel the need to read so quickly and try and prove his worth in other ways. So if I had to choose between these two people, I think I would rather be Guan Yin. I don't think the way in which Harold Bloom reads is wrong. I think that there may be people in the department that are maybe possibly sympathetic with Bloom. There's obviously a lot of literary critics that are influenced by Bloom, and you have to go and read Bloom and think about what your view is. But I think that a poem necessarily unfolds to us. It doesn't just kind of give us the answer in one go, and if you read it like that, you will find it very frustrating and boring. Isn't that a horrible word? We're always told that we can't use boring when we're talking about texts. And I think you will find texts boring that are kind of dense and, as I say, poetic and filled with kind of different kinds of sounds if you just try and read it quickly. Okay. I also think that if you let the poem unfold or sort of move through you, as it were, just kind of think about, reflect on the experience that you're having when you're reading, that you get to what I think we might call the truth of the text. Now, when we read texts, there's often a kind of right answer that we might be trying to get to. And I don't know whether you do that at A-level or not. I think maybe you do because of the way in which they kind of give you ticks for certain answers and no ticks for other answers. You know, of course there are things that you can say that are wrong about the text, as in, like, Howl was not written in 2010. That's wrong. But I think, you know, that's a sort of matter of common sense. The truth of the text is something that you're going to get to, which is beyond the right and wrongness of the text, which I hope this department doesn't care about. I certainly don't care about right and wrongs. I don't see right and wrong is a useful binary to use when you're reading texts. Truth, however, is a very sticky word for literary critics. A lot of literary critics don't like the word truth because it suggests that somehow you're getting to a fixed answer. And that's not really what I mean by truth. I think there's lots of truths. You can read the text and think it's one thing one day, and you can read the text the next day and think it's about something else, partly because of the experiences that you have in the world. Poems, for example, that are about mourning. We do a lot of poems about mourning, the kind of experience of bereavement on Romantic Victorian Poetry, which is the course I teach on in the second year. And those texts, you know, make sense to some people, you know, because they've had bereavement. They make sense in a different way than when you've read them at a different stage. So, of course, texts will have different truths to you at different times in your life because of the way in which you read them. So it doesn't make sense to say that a poem has the right answer. What it does make sense to do, as I've said, is to kind of go through the poem and observe the sound. Often I like to think about it myself as sort of when I'm reading a poem for the first time, to think about sort of words almost having little speech bubbles coming out of them. What is in that speech bubble? What is that word saying? If the words were a cartoon, what are the speech bubbles coming out of individual words, especially words that Ginsberg uses, like animal soup time? What does that mean? What is the little speech bubble that comes out of the phrase animal soup time? Well, I'm going to tell you what I think. Now I'm going to do a little close reading of a bit of Howell, which I think is going to be here. Oh, that's good. It was there when I looked a minute ago. Okay, let's go on to here and find an amazing text of Howell. What do we do without the internet? Here we are. Don't do this, obviously, at home. You have to use the proper text. And oh, that's big enough. I'm going to read it anyway. It's only a little passage. I want to look at the last bit of part one. R. Carl. Yeah, don't worry if you can't see it. But, you know, it's there. It's here. Now, I'm going to start talking about part one here, but I'm going to go to the end of part one, and then next week I'll talk about the beginning of part one, and then I will go a bit linear to try and kind of make sense of the poem. So the third lecture will be about part two, the last lecture will be about part three of the poem. But I thought it's kind of interesting to just get right into the text and think about how to close read it. Now, in future weeks, I will give you some context. What happened in Ginsberg's day? What was going on with him? Why did he write this? And I might talk about that a little bit now, but I'm not going to overwhelm you with that. I personally think you should get into the poem yourselves before you start thinking about the context. Never read the introduction to a poem before you're about to read it. Of course, all this comes down to time, doesn't it? That's why we read kind of things like, Wikipedia. And spark notes and all that sort of thing, because we haven't got time. Well, that's why you should all work on poems, because if you work on a sonnet, you have got time, because it's only 14 lines, or if it's kind of a weird sonnet, it might have 15 lines. But, you can always take a bit of a poem and think about it in a close way. It is better for you to choose a small section of a poem and really think about that and have something to say about that in your seminar than it is to try and plow through the whole thing and have nothing to say. You'll see that when you get onto courses like Euronovel, where you have impossibly long books to read. Of course, you should read them, but you should also just kind of think about extracts that you can talk about and read them almost like they're poems, and it gives you a lot more from them. So here's this last bit of Howell where Ginsberg turns to his friend, Carl. So I'll read this out, and then I'm going to talk about it. Ah, Carl. While you are not safe, I am not safe. And now you're really in the total animal soup of time. And who, therefore, ran through the icy streets, obsessed with the sudden flash of the alchemy, of the use of the ellipse, the catalogue, the meter, and the vibrating plane? Who dreamt and made incarnate gaps in time and space through images juxtaposed and trapped the archangel of the soul between two visual images and joined the elemental verbs and set the noun and dash of consciousness together, jumping with sensation of pater omnipotens aeternia deus, to recreate the syntax and measure of poor human prose and stand before you speechless and intelligent and shaking with shame, rejected yet not confessing out the soul to conform to the rhythm of thought in his naked and endless head. The madman, bum, and angel beat in time unknown, yet putting down here what might be left to say in time come after death, and rose reincarnate in the ghostly clothes of jazz, in the gold horn shadow of the band, and blew the suffering of America's naked mind for love into an Eli, Eli, Lama, Lama, Sabak Thani saxophone cry that shivered the cities down to the last radio with the absolute heart of the poem of life butchered out of their own bodies, good to eat 1,000 years. Wow, wow, isn't that great? He just says everything that, that we want to know about poetry, that it lifts us up from poor human prose, that it gives us a different way in, that it makes us think about time in a different way. Now, the first thing that we can do with this extract, if we don't really know anything about Ginsberg, is to listen to the words and to listen to the first line and think about how that sounds to us. Ah, oh, Carl, well, you are not safe. I am not safe. Well, that sounds to me like an image of friendship. He's addressing it to someone who he says, you know, well, you, brother, are not safe. I am not safe. If you're not happy, I'm not happy. Well, that tells us that the poem's about friendship, but also about collegiality and community and shared responses to the world. It's not a poet that's just speaking from one position. He's addressing it outward. It also tells us that this is a poem that's kind of in a real world. It's directed to this guy called Carl, who, as I'll talk about next week, is Ginsberg's real friend, Carl Solomon, who he met in a mental institution, and they became friends for life. But why were they both in a mental institution? Well, because they didn't conform to what 1950s America thought was normal. They didn't conform to normativity, what it means to be a normal in the world. Very few writers do conform to that. Very few academics do, but that's in a totally different way. Because they can't cope in the world as it is, and Ginsberg will attack 1950s America, and that's why the poem will later go on trial, and trial for obscenity. But if we just return to the poem, his attack on everyday things and on normativity is reflected in his presentation, I think, of time. We know that he's addressing it to his friend, ah, Carl, hey, it's a kind of nice, ah, breathing out. And you're in that total animal soup of time. Time, for most of us, living in Western capitalism, as Ginsberg was, in a very similar kind of political environment, time is experienced in a linear, straightforward way, a bit like how we read a novel. This is how we experience our lives, isn't it? We get up very early to come to lectures. We have breakfast. You know, we go to seminars. We might go to the library. We have lunch. We go home. We do some reading. We go to the pub. Watch television, we go to bed. We might do something like that every day in a quite sort of similar way. And we might call that clock time. It's clock time. We look at the clock. I'm looking at the clock there and I can see how many minutes we've got left. And you know that at 11 o'clock you're going to go somewhere else. It's clock time. It's linear. Well, what does the animal soup of time mean? What is animal soup? It sounds different to linear time. It's suggestive of a kind of mixed-up, liquid, brothy, circling movement that's full of physical, beast-like, animalistic time. The way Ginsberg describes time might help us, I think, read his words not in a linear way. Here's the start of the poem, here's the end. How doesn't really make sense, I don't think, like that. But as a way in which we make sense of words across the poem, connections across the poem. And this is why he says that a bit later in this extract that poetry and the way in which madmen, bums and angels, they're the same for Ginsberg because they're both kind of isolated figures that are outside of the normal world, madmen because they're not accepted, angels because, you know, everyone thinks Christianity is this kind of made-up thing or that people that believe in angels are kind of nuts. He says their time is much more like jazz. It incarnates itself. It makes itself flesh in the ghostly clothes of jazz. Well, what's jazz? What does jazz sound like? It's all over the place. It's syncopatic, isn't it? It kind of moves back and forth between notes. Jazz musicians improvise. They improvise different sections of pieces of music in lots of different ways, on lots of different nights when they're performing that music. There isn't the same kind of performance. And that's very much our experience of Howl. It'd be very difficult to read Howl in exactly the same way. you could learn to, but that would take a lot of time. That would be, I think, a kind of animal soup of time, because it would be a confusing thing to do. So how do we connect words across the poem? How do words look in the poem when they're shoved next to other bits of the poem? What would it be like to take a few lines out here and put them in part three? What would that mean? Words in the animal soup of time might look different when they're in one bit of the soup, next to some cabbage, to another bit of the soup, like a crouton. You know, there's a sort of soupiness that is here that's introducing us to the way in which we should read. But we don't know that until we get to this bit of the poem. We don't know that until here. So that's why we have to kind of think about going back and forth as we read. So, no wonder Ginsberg says Carl can run through the icy streets, seeing the world in suddenly poetic terms here. He's in his animal soup, and he suddenly sees the world as a poem, as a catalogue of meter and vibrations and nouns and dashes of consciousness jumping together with sensation. As well as Ginsberg's use of poetry giving us different ways of thinking about friendship and language and time, there's another key way in which Ginsberg presents poetry to us, and it's something that I'll talk about in the other lectures too, and that is the way in which he produces poetry or presents it to us as sacred. We can understand the word sacred as meaning religious, and I think that's okay. That's what I'm interested in myself in my own research, is religion and poetry, the relationship between religion and poetry. So I'm quite interested in going through Ginsberg and working out where he gets all of his religious images from. But if we're not particularly interested in religion, we might just think about the poem as sacred anyway. If you look sacred up, it means to make holy, to bless. And that's something that I think the poem does. Even though it's a kind of an angry poem in parts, what it's supposed to do is make its readers feel blessed. It's a gentling poem, if you like. It gentles us. It makes us feel as though we have got something to contribute to the world, even if we're in a difficult state of mind or state of health, for example. So I think that kind of image of the kind of the madmen, bums, and the kind of images I think that you get earlier in the poem of sort of misfits and people that don't quite fit into society is brought to a climax here in the words that Ginsberg cites from Christ, who more than Christ is in a position of being totally frustrated on the cross, but still representing something holy and gentling and loving. So we can hear the way in which Jesus is taken to voice the suffering of America for Ginsberg in these lines: the suffering of America's naked mind for love into an Eli, Eli, Lama, Lama, Sabachthani saxophone. So what does that mean? What does Eli, Eli, Lama, Lama, Sabachthani mean? Well, we need to go to the Bible. We need to look it up. And here's the original in the Gospel of Matthew, which is a description of those hours when Jesus is on the cross. He's been on the cross and he's waiting to die. He's a real man at that point, and he's waiting to kind of go through the suffering so he can die. Matthew says, "Now from the sixth hour until the ninth hour," 9 hours, it's a long time, "there was darkness over all the land. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, 'Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani,' that is, 'My God, why have you forsaken me?'" That's in Matthew 27, if you want to look it up. Ginsberg repeats the word lama, which isn't in Matthew, which is the word for why, to underline how nonsensical 1950s America has become. So instead of having, my God, why have you forsaken me, which Jesus says, you know, even though he trusts God, he still is stressed out. You know, he's in a lot of pain after 9 hours of being strung up on the cross. Ginsberg has that line, repeat the word, why? My God, why have you forsaken us, is what Ginsberg wants to ask 1950s America. Why is it censoring homosexuality? Why is it censoring pacifism and communism and vegetarians? You know, anyone that's kind of a bit sort of seen as not normal or to the side of society is being punished. Political films, even religions that don't fit into a kind of 1950s model of Christian evangelicalism, are all being censored, and people are being put in prison for just having views and having ideas. That's why Ginsberg is so angry here. The sound of the word why, even though it's encoded in llama llama, the repetition of it, is what renders this passage so moving and so devastating all at once. It's the poetry as much as the politics that communicates the message. There are countless political documents of this time that, in fact, no one reads because they're just censored straight away, whereas Howell does go to trial. It's put on trial for obscenity, but the trial is lost and Ginsberg wins. Howell is kind of republished because there's a sort of sense in which, yes, actually Howell is kind of obscene, but the people that are trying to prosecute Ginsberg don't understand why it's obscene. They don't really understand what they're prosecuting, which is partly Ginsberg's point of attack, that censorship is done without reason. There's not even a real politics behind it, apart from, perhaps we might say, a politics of fear. Fear of the other, fear of what other people are thinking, and thinking that it might not be right, or it might not kind of make sense. There's a great essay by a fabulous theologian called Stanley Hauerwas, which is called Why the Gays as a Group are Morally Superior to the Christians as a Group. Hauerwas is a Christian and a theologian. He's not gay. And his essay is all about the military and why gays aren't allowed in the military in America. And he says, you know, I'm a pacifist. I don't think anyone should have to be in the military. He said, but if gays can't be in the... Gays, what does that mean? Can't be in the military, nor can Christians. Because, you know, those Christians, you know, the way they baptize you is that they do it with water. And if you end up being in the shower with one of those Christians, they might secretly baptize you and you'd never even know. So Hauerwas says, well, Christians can't be in the military then. But Hauerwas is a very clever theologian, and he's doing something quite similar to Ginsberg. He's trying to show the absurdity of that kind of censorship, and that kind of fear of the other. Okay. So, just to conclude, what I've tried to suggest in this lecture is that you shouldn't be afraid of poetry, because it's the one genre, I think, out of all genres, novels and plays and everything else that you read, that allows you to think and feel what you want to. Poems aren't about something. They might make references to events or ideas, but if you don't know anything about these events or ideas, you should still be able to get something from hearing the sounds in the poem, from being able to read the sounds and observe the sounds from your pose of ease. There are lots of answers to, I think, the question of why we might read poetry, and what we can kind of ultimately get from it. And I'm just going to conclude by introducing yet another figure. I mean, you don't need to remember all of these figures that we kind of tell you about. There might be kind of one or two over the course of the year that you think are particularly interesting and you want to go and then look them up. But don't sort of feel overwhelmed by all of the critics that we introduce you to. But a critic that I found particularly helpful in thinking about why poetry is so important in Ginsberg, but in other poets that I work on too, like William Wordsworth, for example, is a philosopher called Martin Heidegger. Now, Martin Heidegger, as a philosopher, instills fear into people in the same way in which poetry does. But in fact, a lot of his writing is quite accessible and straightforward. And he, in the 1960s, he wrote an essay called What Are Poets For? What Are Poets For? And I think, instead of saying that they're, well, in the essay, he does not say that they're necessary because we need them to entertain us, or to teach us things that we don't know, or to show us how clever they are, or to encourage a love of arts in the world. He would not be one of those people that wants to put poems on the tube or poems up in parks. Why? Why should people have to read those if they don't want to? It's just going to work. Why should they have to read a Shakespeare sonnet on the tube? Whenever I see a Shakespeare sonnet on the tube, I feel confronted by it. You know, why should I have to read this? I'd rather read that advert about insurance next to it. It's much more interesting and engaging, to me anyway. Heidegger says it's pointless trying to push poetry at people all the time and make poetry fun and sort of present it in an accessible way. Because what does that mean? All that someone's doing in presenting it in an accessible way is giving you their view. Well, it's okay for me to give you my view because I'm just doing it in an exemplary way. Exemplary, I meant by example rather than exemplary. That would be an idiotic thing to say and very arrogant. But what Heidegger says is that poets are for protecting our sense of being human. That is his argument. And that is his argument in all of the books he writes, which are many. Heidegger writes a lot of work. But he says that poetry protects what it means to be human. And that is a question that is at the center of Ginsberg's poem, because the way in which the law works in 1950s America, where it imprisons people who are communists or gay or vegetarians, is because it says they're not human. They don't have, somehow they've lost a bit of their humanness. And we have this debate constantly, don't we, in kind of much more kind of intense and political ways. What does it mean to be human? It kind of touches on subjects like abortion and euthanasia and disability. They're big questions. And Heidegger says poetry, it can't solve those problems. What can solve those problems? We don't know. Maybe surgeons will be able to solve problems in the future, but they can't at the moment. So Heidegger says poetry shelters our sense of being. That's a very important word for Heidegger, being. That's what he means by human. What does it mean? What does our being mean? What is that part of us that is sort of central to ourselves before we start performing in a particular context? You know yourselves that you will go into a seminar and you'll be quite different in that seminar than you are with your parents, for example, or with your grandparents, or with your friends, or, you know, with a lover. There's lots of different ways in which we perform at different times. And Heidegger says there is something before that moment in which we start to perform in the world, which poetry protects, or it reconnects us to. But you can't reconnect to that if you're constantly trying to think, what's this a reference to? Is this a reference to this text? Have I read it? Is it this? Is it that? That's not what I think Heidegger asks us to do. He says that a poem allows us to look inwards and assess what we're feeling. And then when we know what we're feeling, we're then able to reread the poem openly and freely without pressure or anxiety. So I would argue, in a way, that reading poetry, just reading it, the experience of reading poetry, which is what I've been talking about, frees us from performing in the world. It frees us, I would argue, from what Marxist critics call ideology. Ideology simply means big ideas in the world that structure any given time. Ideology shifts all the time because different ideas become popular at different times. But ideologies, I suppose, that dominate the Western world now would be capitalism, the family, heterosexuality, education. They're all seen as things that are important in some ways. And I think that poetry frees us from ideology and allows us to kind of get back to something that is essential. And that's what poetry reconnects us with. Now, Marxist critics, if they were here in the room, would already have shot me for saying that, because they would say that that is one of the most conservative things I can say. They would say, you cannot free yourself from ideology. We're in it. It's like a big box, but there isn't any outside to it. So you can't just get out of the box. I think you can get out of the box, and I think There's a kind of a world, an emotional world, that you can get out of the box into. A Marxist critic would say that there isn't. And I will talk about that Marxist response next week and give you a different kind of perspective on the poem, which does think in a different way about what it means to be locked in ideology and read the poem in a bit more of a material way rather than just thinking about our experience of it. Okay, that's the end. No, please. The Marxists, they will come and get me for clapping that.